Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. About 4 years ago, it's a long time, but I remember it very well. We did a really interesting show with a Miami-based writer, Mario Alejandro Ariza, on whether or not Miami's future is apocalyptic. He had a book out back then, Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe. And he saw Miami and the city and its architecture and its geography as symbolic of the coming environmental apocalypse. That's one way, of course, of seeing Miami. Many Americans see Miami through their own particular prisms, their own ideologies, their own ethnicities and cultures. My guest today has a very different way of thinking about Miami from Ariza. Dr. Vince Houghton is a longtime expert on cryptology and spying. He's the author of all sorts of books on spies and one kind of nuclear issue or another. He is also the head of the National Cryptologic Museum. And so one would expect his view of Miami to be rather different from Ariza's. And of course it is. He is the co-author of a new book called Covert City, The Cold War and the Making of Miami. He puts Miami back in history, and he's joining us from just outside Washington, D.C., next to Andrews Air Force Base. Vince, as I joked before we went live, at an undisclosed location.
Exactly. Yep.
So before we get into Miami, what draws you, or what drew you to spying? Were you a boy who always wanted to grow up and become a spy?
No, I actually wanted to grow up and study nuclear weapons, which I kind of do anyway. The intelligence side of things came in when I was deployed to the Balkans in the 1990s with the U.S. Army. My bio lets me say I worked with both civilian and military intelligence agencies in multiple capacities, which is the most cleared way we can possibly talk about it. But I got a chance to see what intelligence did. I got a chance to see the impact that it had. And then I realized that I could kind of bring two things together and look at nuclear weapons from an intelligence perspective, which is what I did a lot of my graduate work on and wrote the first book on. And then just kind of found my way into museums, which is where I am today.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, you've written some books on nuclear issues. One book, Nuking the Moon, and another one, The Nuclear Spy. So Miami is a long way from an undisclosed location next to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, D.C. Vince, how did you get to Miami?
Well, this is going home for me. Miami's my hometown. I grew up there, spent the majority of my formative years in Miami. My parents met there back in the 60s as undergrads at the University of Miami. That's where my dad and mom grew up. And so this was, you know, not necessarily a long jump for me, because it was, I watched a lot of this history happen while I was there. Same with my co-author. I think one of the fascinating things about Eric, who unfortunately can't join us today because he's a Coast Guard reservist. And
Eric Driggs.
Eric Driggs, a Coast Guard reservist. And we just had some unfortunate situation up in Baltimore that the Coast Guard is dealing with. And so he's busy today dealing with bridges falling down. And so I'm going solo, but Eric and I grew up together. Eric and I grew up together in Miami. And although his name doesn't suggest it, Eric is 100% Cuban. Both of his parents came over after Castro took power. And so he grew up, although we have all the same experiences. We went to the same schools, had the same friends, played the same sports, rooted for the same teams. We approached life from a very different perspective. My family, I'm 14th generation American, go back to the 18th century in the United States, and even before that, up in the Boston area in the early 17th century. Whereas Eric is experiencing all this as a first generation American. His, like I said, his parents came over after the Castro Revolution. So we were able to kind of come together with very, very different philosophies on what we observed and lived through in the history of Miami. And I think it makes for a fascinating book because we played off each other. You know, this would have been a very different book if I had written all of it, and a very different book if Eric had written all of it. But the two of us kind of came together, were able to balance each other out. And I think that's the success of this book, is how balanced it is.
Well, when Eric fixes that bridge in Baltimore, I'll have to come on the show. It's interesting you bring up Cuba, of course. And the argument in the book is that the relationship between Miami and Cuba, politically, culturally, economically, is a very complicated one. We did a show a couple of years ago with a Cuban or an American historian of Cuba, Ada Ferrer. Her book, An American History of Cuba, won the Pulitzer Prize. And she argues that, as you can tell from the title, Cuba, An American History, suggests that the whole history of Cuba is a kind of mirror of America itself. And I'm guessing you're saying the same about Miami.
Very much so. And I think one thing that we notice, Eric and I, is that so much of the Cold War history that is considered the most interesting and academic. Like if you took a class at a university and it taught Cold War history, you'd have a certain set of books that everyone reads. And not a single one of them mentioned Miami as a key component in Cold War history. And we wanted to fix that because we think that Miami is a microcosm of what America went through in the Cold War. In many respects, you look at Miami as arguably the second most important American city in the Cold War, behind Washington, of course. And so we thought we needed to bring Miami up to the same conversations as Washington, Moscow, Beijing, Berlin, London, the Cold War cities that we've been learning about for 70 years. Miami's never in that conversation. We argue that it needs to be. But to get a full picture of what happened during that period, you can't have the conversation without bringing in Miami, not only from a cultural standpoint, but from a foreign policy standpoint.
Yeah, I'd never thought of it. And when I saw the book, I thought, I've got to get these guys on the show because it's a fascinating thesis. And on reflection, it makes sense. When someone pitches a book called Covert City, as you say, you'd be thinking Berlin of all places, maybe Casablanca, right. But certainly not Miami. So, Vince, not everyone is as intimate with the history of Miami or of Cuba. Just remind us of the background to the Cold War in terms of Cuban involvement in that, and of course the post Second World War history of Cuba itself.
Yeah, so Cuba really goes through two major revolutions. One is in 1898 from the Spanish, at which point it becomes its own country for the first time in a long time. But it's independence with a leash. The United States is very much involved in the Cuban economy, very much involved in Cuban politics, and even in some cases, foreign policy.
And it's where Teddy Roosevelt, of course, made his name in some ways.
Right. You know, the San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders, and that was the Spanish-American War. And so when Cuba becomes independent, it's a quasi-independence because we're always sitting back and making sure that they don't go in a direction we don't want them to go. Well, in 1959, they go in a direction we don't want them to go. When Fidel Castro takes power from a pretty horrible person, Batista, who was the dictator in charge of Cuba, we let him do what he wanted to do because he was very business friendly to the United States. But for most people just kind of held their nose in the United States because he was just a pretty terrible person. So when Castro comes to power, there are some people in American government that are like, you know what? This might be better. You know, he's bringing a kind of a sense of democracy that lasts very, very, very short period of time because Castro begins to nationalize important things like United Fruit Company properties and begins to kick out all the American economic interests. And so we're in a position, we the United States, where we get very leery very quickly of Castro. And unbeknownst to him and us, his brother and a man named Che Guevara, who some people may have heard of, had already begun dealing with the Soviet Union. And realizing very quickly that the United States was not going to have any kind of friendly relationship with a left-leaning country 90 miles from the United States. And so, you look back in history and say, was Cuba that big a deal? Well, it certainly felt like it in 1959 and 1960. Having a Soviet satellite country 90 miles from the United States was something the American government, regardless of political party or liberal or conservative, well, they weren't going to abide. And so very quickly, Miami which is the closest major city to Cuba and where most of the Cuban exiles end up settling when they leave Cuba after 59, becomes far more important than it ever has before for American foreign policy.
One reason people may be familiar with that period when it comes to Cuba is from one of the great movies, Godfather 2.
Right.
I'm sure, Vince, you're all too familiar with that. Some wonderful wonderful episodes in Cuba itself. How accurate did Corleone get, the Godfather, how accurately did they get Cuba? When was it imagined? I think it was 59.
Right. So it's taking place at the very end of 1958. Castro takes power on New Year's Day, 1959. So the movie itself is focusing on 1958. The famous scenes near the end of the movie.
At the end, the airlift.
Yep.
That's New Year's Eve because of all the celebration in the club at the beginning.
Exactly. So you have New Year's Eve, you have Castro coming to power. And what's really accurate about it is how surprising it is to everyone. You know, they're still having a party, right? They have no worry that Castro's forces are going to come stomping into Havana, which is kind of what happens to the United States. You know, this is a ragtag band of, you know, bearded riffraff that have come out of the mountains and created a unlikely revolution against an American supported dictatorial state.
And one of the memorable, so much of The Godfather 2, which are memorable, one of the memorable scenes is the one featuring Hyman Roth, a Jewish American mafia guy, at a meeting. I think it was on a Havana rooftop, featuring a lot of powerful American capitalists. Maybe this was a kind of Marxist reading of Cuban history. But were American businessmen and American criminal leaders like Hyman Roth, were they really involved in the Cuba of the late 50s?
Absolutely. And I think that's what made Bautista so vile to everyone is not only was he open to allowing American companies to exploit Cuban workers and Cuban land, but he was incredibly corrupt. And anyone who wanted to come in, including the mafia, could buy their way onto the island with gambling and prostitution and all the vices that are usually associated with organized crime. Bautista, as long as his pockets were full, looked the other way. And that's why a lot of people looked at the Castro Revolution from Cuba as a great thing. Even if they weren't communists, right? Even if they were normal, you know, non-communists, even in some cases capitalists, anything might be better than what Bautista had presented. This doesn't last very long, but the beginning was maybe Castro would be good for Cuba.
And let's remind ourselves of the real politics of the time, not Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone, but the men in charge in Washington, D.C. JFK is remembered now fondly by most Americans. But in Cold War terms, he was somewhat of a reactionary. And he wasn't, when we look back at his career, Cuba probably wasn't the high point, was it?
Certainly
in his reading, his understanding, his take on what was happening there.
Well, his take is something that is passed down to him from the Eisenhower administration. You know, so 1959, the entire year of 1959 and the entire year of 1960, so the first 2 years of the Castro government wasn't the Kennedy administration, it was the Eisenhower administration. You know, Kennedy doesn't become president until January of 1961. So the first real understanding and analysis of Castro's politics comes from Eisenhower and his leadership, which actually Kennedy keeps on, especially people like Alan Dulles, who's the director of the CIA. So Kennedy is looking at the Cuba through the prism that Eisenhower looked at it beforehand. And that's somewhat understandable, right? If you're looking at foreign policy, if you're looking at threats to American security, Kennedy is going to take a five-star general, Dwight Eisenhower, his advice, even though they're from different parties.
It was a much more consensual time. I mean, the ideological difference between Eisenhower and JFK and his administration was much less sharp than between, I don't know, Trump and Biden.
Yeah, I mean, they were called Cold War liberals, you know, so they had a liberal philosophy when it came to domestic policy. But as far as looking at anti-communism and the Soviet Union as some kind of monolithic leader of worldwide communism was something that everyone shared. And so there wasn't a lot of daylight between the Kennedy administration and the Eisenhower administration before it. And so Kennedy, his philosophy toward Cuba was evolved from what Eisenhower comes from. I mean, Bay of Pigs is a great example of this, right?
Let's get to the Bay of Pigs, which was one of the low points, I think, of not just the JFK presidency, but of post-war American politics. What was it, and why was it such a disaster?
So people have been debating this, you know, now for 60 years, why it was such a disaster. But essentially, Miami in 1961 was chock full of people who were exiles from Cuba, who had been kicked out or had to leave because of persecution, and then resettled in the South Florida area, particularly Miami. And they wanted to get back in. They wanted to go after Castro at a time before he'd been able to consolidate his power. The Pentagon had a fairly decent plan put together by the Eisenhower administration. And in some ways, that plan, it's counterfactual to say, but looking at that plan, it probably would have worked better than the one they eventually come up with, which was a CIA-based operation. And you look at this through that lens and say, okay, would this ever have worked? And again, that's counterfactual. Maybe it never would have one way or the other. But it was changed very much the last minute, with people that didn't quite understand the not only the politics of the region that they were going, the Bay of Pigs region itself was very heavily pro-Castro because they were poor farmers and people who would not readily decide to switch sides and join up with the Cuban exile invaders. And of course, at the last minute, John Kennedy calls off the air support that had been promised to the operation, mainly because it looked like it was going to fail one way or the other. There was a large ship, the Houston, which was carrying over ammunition and weapons, that was hit by a direct shot, arguably the luckiest shot in warfare, by a Cuban ground installation and blew it up. So essentially all of their equipment, all the ammunition that they were going to use to actually attack the island was not available to them. And at that point, they weren't going to win one way or the other. Kennedy looked at it and said, we're not going to get ourselves involved. We're calling off the airstrike. So Kennedy gets blamed. And in many respects, the blame is not...
And the blame is shared with Bobby Kennedy as well, who takes a lot of the responsibility, fairly or not.
It's kind of one Kennedy, you get both Kennedys in this
and
situation.
They were both, Bobby, of course, was Attorney General. So let's take a break, Vince, because now we're really getting into this deep. We've got to the Bay of Pigs. We haven't got to the missile crisis yet, and we haven't got to Miami as a bed of spies. But I want to remind everyone that great guests like Vince are brought to us by Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Wonderful new publication, often dealing with contemporary historical subjects like the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Vince Hewton to talk more about Miami, the Cold War, and America's true covert city.
The noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Vince Houghton, the co-author of Covert City, Fascinating New History of Miami, the Florida City. Covert City, the Cold War and the Making of Miami. Vince, we talked about Bay of Pigs, and now we get to the missile crisis. If the Bay of Pigs was the low point of the JFK presidency, the missile crisis was the high point. Tell us about this and Miami's association with it.
Yeah, so the long and the short of the missile crisis is that Nikita Khrushchev realized he was vastly outgunned when it came to nuclear capability in the Cold War. Most people don't know this, but in 1962, the United States had a 17-to-1 numerical advantage in deliverable warheads, right? So every warhead the Soviets could put on a target in the West, we could put 17 on them. And so Khrushchev was looking for ways to fix this inequality. And Cuba seemed to be the no-brainer. We had already shown our willingness to invade Cuba. And so by putting missiles there, Khrushchev hoped that he could kill two birds with one stone. One, he could somewhat equalize the numerical and strategic disadvantage in nuclear weapons. And two, he could help protect a Soviet ally, especially one so close to the United States, to send a message to the rest of the world and those that might want to join up in the Soviet side, that the United States could not bully them, that the Soviet Union would stand by them, protect them with the most important weapon that they had, nuclear weapons. And so the long and the short of it is, he thought he was going to sneak these weapons into Cuba and then announce it to the world. They're here, they're operational, there's nothing you can do about it. But American intelligence was able to locate and detect them prior to them being operational, which gave John Kennedy a pretty big choice, you know, one that we don't necessarily envy, even in hindsight, of what do you do about it, right? Do you take out the missiles militarily before they're operational and risk World War III? Or do you go the different route, which he eventually chooses, and create a blockade of Cuba to force the Soviets to move back and pull the missiles out without any shots being fired? And that's what he chooses to do. We now know there was a back channel deal between the Soviets and the Americans that if the United States pledged not only to not intervene in Cuban politics in the future, at least militarily, but also to remove our Jupiter missiles, which are short range and medium range missiles from Turkey, then they would pull the missiles out of Cuba. And this was a deal that was not announced publicly. We actually don't find out about this until the Cold War is over. But by keeping it secret, everyone's able to save face.
And well, everyone claims victory, particularly JFK. And
right.
He claimed a manly victory in the crisis, which perhaps wasn't as accurate. So let's go back to Miami. What was happening in Miami during both the Bay of Pigs, but particularly the missile crisis? Was it a den of spies?
Well, Miami's been a den of spies since the Cuban Revolution took place. The Castro government was not stupid when they took power. They realized how tentative and how very fragile that their power was going to be with the United States as close as they were. And so as many Cubans left the island after Castro takes power, the Castro regime is very good at sprinkling in intelligence officers within the people who are legitimate exiles. And so even the first people who come over to Miami after the Castro Revolution included some members of Cuban intelligence. As the Bay of Pigs fails, this number goes way up because Castro is absolutely going to make sure he knows what the exile community is up to. And so more and more people are sent over, the vast majority of them looking as though they're legitimate exiles. They ingratiate themselves to the Cuban community, and the whole time they're sending information back to Castro's government inside Havana. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, what you get is a militarization of Miami. You go from being a CIA station of some size, actually the second largest CIA facility in the world, behind only the headquarters in Langley, was in Miami in the early 1960s, to a fully militarized...
That wasn't the unofficial. That was an official fact.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not us making guesses. That's the CIA station in Miami was called JM Wave. It had hundreds of CIA personnel and thousands, if not 15,000-20,000 Cuban exiles on the payroll. At one point in 1960, it was contributing about one third of Miami's economy. So the CIA had a massive, humongous influence. Yeah. Yeah, a humongous influence on how Miami was built. But we're talking about 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's when the military shows up. And you have entire divisions of American soldiers and Marines and sailors and Air Force, especially what we kind of don't use today, thank God, but anti-aircraft batteries with nuclear weapons, Nike ground-to-air missile systems, that the warheads were actually tactical nuclear weapons that were going to be used to try to shoot down any kind of an attack that comes from Cuba. It became a fortress Miami, And the interesting thing about that is when the Cuban Missile Crisis ends without a shot fired, the troops leave, but the infrastructure stays. The anti-air nuclear tip missiles stay. The infrastructure at Homestead, which is a suburb of Miami, Homestead Air Force Base remains. And so the militarization doesn't stay exactly the same. We're not going to house multiple army divisions down there. But the idea of Miami becoming a bit of a fortress area for protecting the United States from its kind of southern flank is something that continues on all the way up to the end of the Cold War.
Does this show, we did a show a year or two ago with the geographer Ian Morris, who believes that geography explains everything. He would, because he's a geographer, of course. Everything from Brexit to Cuba to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and he had a book out, Geography is Destiny. Does the story of Cuba, does the story of Miami, Vince, prove that geography is indeed destiny? Was there a certain inevitability about this, given Miami's geographic position?
I'm not a geographer, so I think history is much more important. But I understand the argument being made. And there's no question that Miami's geography plays a huge role in its importance during this time period. I mean, the importance of Miami goes back to the days of the pirates, where it was just a great place to smuggle stuff in and out, and continues to today, where you're looking at Miami as this hotbed of international intrigue. But certainly during the Cold War, geography played a massive role. I mean, Miami was considered the capital of Latin America. It was the center of Latin American economic trade and finance. Its proximity to Cuba makes it very important when it comes to the Cold War politics of the time. And then being in Florida, I mean, one of the arguments we make near the end of the book kind of takes it beyond looking at Cold War intrigue and more about the importance of it politically, where Florida becomes so important to American national politics and Miami kind of becomes so important to Florida politics that the city itself, geographically, if it was in Idaho, obviously it wouldn't matter as much. And it didn't have this influx and this easy access from Latin America. It wouldn't matter as much. So yeah, I think geography plays a huge role in why Miami becomes such an important city.
And what about in the history of covert operations? I seem to remember, and you know this stuff inside out, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that the Cubans were also involved in Watergate, certainly in burglarizing the Watergate building. Is there a Miami connection to Watergate?
There's a Miami connection in that all the burglars, or most of the burglars, were from Miami one way or the other. Even non-Cubans like E. Howard Hunt made his home down in Miami. So it wasn't planned and executed from Miami, but there's a lot of Watergate tendrils that lead back to South Florida.
There's a saying there, something like, America may be able to leave Miami, but Miami can't leave America, or something like that. So even after the missile crisis, which America in theory, I guess, won or presented itself as the victor, Miami remains a center for covert activity of one kind or another. So my question for you, Vince, is now when we think of Miami, we think of rollerbladers. We think of tech people now who have gone from Silicon Valley to Miami. Is there any truth to that? Or does Miami, even today in 2024, does it remain a covert city?
Well, I think what's interesting is most history that deals with Miami, even the little bit that does, kind of stops after the Cuban Missile Crisis, or the real covert aspects of the city start after the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? That's when it gets interesting, because we very overtly say we're not going to use the U.S. military to overthrow Cuba. We don't say we're not going to try to stop overthrowing Cuba. So what it does is it goes from the Pentagon to the CIA. So now it becomes even more covertly fueled. And that's when the real shenanigans begin, when we have operations that focus on ousting Castro using nefarious means, clandestine means, supporting Cuban exile communities and Cuban exile groups, where we look at the spread of communism in Latin America as an off-branching of the Cuban Revolution and start fighting that elsewhere. I mean, if you think of the Iran-Contra, the Contra part of Iran-Contra in the 1980s, which was in Nicaragua, this was an offshoot of our efforts against the Cubans. And so this becomes much more of a covert city after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, I'm guessing Reagan would have. I mean, he's of course from Southern California, but he might have rather enjoyed himself in Miami, in a way that the Miami and Reagan go together like fish and chips.
Well, a lot of his top leadership was used Miami as a jumping off point for a lot of the Reagan era policies. I mean, the Iran-Contra operation was planned in a hotel room in Miami. Oliver North met up with all the people who would eventually run this operation downtown Miami, where everything else takes place. You know, look, yes, there are beaches, there's rollerblades, there's tech, you know, billionaires, there's the Russians now have moved into Miami. But that's always kind of, that's very much a facade. That is what is going on the surface. Behind it is corruption. I mean, I think Miami had 5 mayors in a row indicted for corruption. It was a record. It was. This is recent. This is not going back to the 80s. This is in the last decade and a half. And today, it's just a fascinating city, to the point where Eric and I, while we were writing this, had to cut ourselves off. We basically said, okay, we're done. That nothing else that happens from now on is going to make this book. Because from the time we wrote it to the time we turned it in to the time it's now being published, we could have written an entire 4 or 5 other chapters.
You could do a follow-up. I'm assuming that there's a Granada chapter in the book, or certainly the invasion of Granada was somehow hatched in Miami too.
Well, I mean, yeah, that you want to call it an invasion. There's
so many preoccupation or whatever you want to call it.
Right. Well, what's crazy about this is literally within the last 2 months, there has been a former ambassador for the United States arrested for spying for Cuba. Right. So talking about high level State Department officials that were just arrested Miami. I'd have to Google his name. Off the top of my head, I don't remember it, because that's one of like 15 different. Eric would know it in a second because he'd actually dealt with that case. But there's one of about 15 different things that have happened in the last year since we started copy editing this that could have been multiple chapters. They just happened now. And it's one of these things that you look at and say, we're not even done with the Cold War in Miami. And that's what, to us, that's what made this city so interesting. Is in 1989 or 1991 or wherever you want to say the Cold War ended, it kept going in South Florida.
But it's taken a new form now, Vince. And again, I'm thinking out loud, correct me. You don't seem shy to correct me when I'm wrong, which is you most of the time. America doesn't fear communism anymore. It fears illegal immigration. And I'm guessing that, in a sense, Miami could be a business conspiratorial center for one kind of business associated with illegal immigration, although it's not on the border itself. How does Miami play in this new quote-unquote Cold War?
So I think you might be overestimating Americans' openness to communism. There are a lot of people who still do fear communism. There are a lot of people who live...
Are there any communists left?
Well, Cuba. That's one that certainly still is.
I guess I forgot about that. But is it a serious sort of communism?
I mean, has anyone ever been? I mean, you can make that really philosophical argument, or the Soviet Union, even communist state. But Cuba's still communist. Venezuela's still communist. Nicaragua, Bolivia, parts of Colombia, the FARC movement in Colombia was very common. So there's a lot of left-leaning people who, you know, tickle communism. And certainly those in Miami who are pushing politics in such a way in the United States that you can't ignore it, because it matters for presidential politics, as Florida always does. There is still a fear of communism. And it's not necessarily this idea of Marxist-Leninism. I mean, we actually redefine this in the book somewhat, and you can use whatever word, whether it's Castroism or Fidelism. It's this idea of the way Castro was able to reshape his country and his image, which is now what has taken root in places like Venezuela, in Bolivia,
kind of like
in Nicaragua.
It's a Cheism, or it's...
Yeah, I mean, Che had a little bit more, was arguably more left than Fidel was. The idea of nationalism...
Probably more romantic.
Yeah, very much more romantic. Fidel was a relatively straightforward pragmatist. The idea of the only way we're going to have control over what we do is that we own it. And so all these foreign influences need to get out. And unfortunately, that doesn't work well with American businesses.
Vince, there's, I guess, legitimate anti-communism. And I guess, I mean, and shall we say, irrational or outrageous anti-communism, of support for reactionary regimes like the Pinochet regime in Chile and elsewhere. Was Miami always a center for that? I mean, there are a lot of wannabe militiamen running around the streets of Miami these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you see both levels of this. That's why it's so important not to be very black and white with what we're seeing down in Miami. You have people who are true freedom fighters. And I don't mean that in the kind of pejorative way. I mean that how their homes were taken away from them and their neighbors were shot by the Castro regime and they had to leave on rafts to get across. And now they truly want to go back and bring democracy, not some kind of right-wing democracy, but true democracy back to Cuba. Then there are those who we kind of chuckle at because they're knuckleheads. And that's a nice way of saying they are the reactionary far right-wing militia types. And there are Cuban immigrants among them, the organizations like Alpha 66 and Omega 7, who were absolutely militant and are to this day. And then you have people who are going to kind of taken the cue from the Blackwaters of the world, or maybe our former contract military types, militia types, and are potentially soldiers of fortune who have headquartered themselves in Miami.
Right, so privatization. Be a natural home in a place like Miami.
Well, absolutely, because you just buy the right person off and you can do whatever you want. And so the
coup, a city of mercenaries, in a way. We just did a show on mercenaries with Elliot Ackerman.
So the coup in Haiti was planned in Miami and financed in Miami. There's an attempted coup in Venezuela about a year ago that was funded and financed and planned in Miami, all done by private contractor types. And, you know, the one in Haiti succeeds. As far as taking out the president who's killed, but now Haiti is a complete and utter basket case of a country. The one in Venezuela fails because the guy running it was an idiot. There's no real better way to say that. It was one of these, we'll get weapons when we get there, and that stuff really doesn't work out well.
Vince, what about the role of the illegal drug industry and all this?
So illegal drugs were able to do two things. One is they picked up on the smuggling routes that were created in the 1930s by the rum runners, by the people who were bringing in booze during Prohibition. And South Florida is such an easy place to smuggle things in because it's a peninsula, it's surrounded by water, you have all the swamps, the Everglades, and the canal systems, and all the different keys that are not populated, and it's impossible to patrol those areas. And then in the late 1970s and 1980s, they took those routes and amplified them tenfold. And you had people who were already there, very good at smuggling things in and out. It wasn't necessarily drugs. It was weapons. It was people. It was operatives who were going in and out of Cuba. Those same smuggling routes were now used to bring in cocaine primarily, but also marijuana and other things from Colombia and from Mexico and from other places in the Caribbean. It became a number that was astronomical, the amount of drugs coming into Miami. And of course, the money followed it. Now, I think people look at the city as everyone is walking around with like white powder on their nose. The vast majority of the drugs that came to Miami didn't stay in Miami. They went through everywhere else in the country. The money, though, is what stayed in Miami. And so in the 1980s, you see another, you know, 1960s, we talked about the idea that CIA dumped a massive amount of money into Miami. That was that first real step of the growth of Miami. The 1980s was the next big step where you have a population boom from the Mariel boat lift in 1980, which brings over thousands and thousands of Cubans from Cuba. And they have an economic boom from the drug trade that coincides and really brings Miami to the level that no one ever expected. I mean, it's not a very big city. I mean, it's expanded now much, much more than it was before. But Miami was a quiet, sleepy little tourist town, even going as recently as the mid-1950s. And now it is one of the most interesting economically viable cities in the world.
And culturally, and it's a home of fine food and certainly for tourism. And finally, I can't resist, although I don't always like bringing his name up, but Donald Trump is, of course, now a Florida resident, might even end up in a Florida jail for all we know. He lives in Mar-a-Lago. Is there a Trumpian epilogue to your narrative, Vince, or is this an entirely different story?
No, there's a little bit. We don't make any kind of assumptions here, but there's an area called Sunny Isles which is a really well-off community just on the outskirts of Miami that is essentially owned by Donald Trump. A number of the apartment buildings, a number of the condos are Donald Trump properties. And what makes Sunny Isles interesting is that it is now called Little Moscow. And this is where the vast majority of the Russians who are moving to Miami or have businesses in Miami are living in Trump properties.
Surprise, surprise.
And what the irony of all ironies is, if you look at the quote-unquote anchor baby crisis, which so many of the anti-immigrant people were bringing up about people coming in from Mexico and having kids in the United States become American citizens, the vast majority of the anchor babies are Russians who are well off and coming into the United States to stay at their condo on Sunny Isles in a Trump property and having their kids in the United States and having U.S. passports, but then going back to Russia. And so the intelligence community, and I can tell you this without breaking any laws, the intelligence community is kind of nervous about this because you're going to have Russians who will grow up in Russia with U.S. passports, which will not make it all that difficult for them to come back later on and get jobs in the United States, sensitive jobs in the United States, because they were born in Miami and not in Russia.
Well, Vince, congratulations on the Cold War and the making of Miami. Fascinating story, intriguing on so many levels. I'm guessing your next book will be a Le Carre-style espionage story based in Miami. Is that right?
You know, if I had a bone of creativity in my body, I'd write novels. But you know, I'm a much more real life is much more interesting to me. So I probably will stick with the nonfiction. But yeah, I think that Miami would be a perfect place if there are any budding spy fiction writers out there. Setting one in Miami would